Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Seeking Witchcraft. I'm your host, Ashley, and today I have on special guest Ellie to help discuss ecstatic practice. Welcome Ellie to the show. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name's Ellie. I'm a Gardnerian High Priestess in London, and I have been interested in ritual and effective ritual and ecstatic practice for about the last 12 years. And for quite a long time before I had kids, I ran open rituals in London for about 3 years once a month, which was great. And since then, I've been experiencing and working with and playing with and really doing a deep dive into how ecstatic practice is so central to witchcraft and particularly to my gardenerian craft. And I'm really excited to kind of share that with everybody.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm so excited to talk about this topic. I think ecstatic practice is something that I want to get better at doing. So I'm really excited to see what knowledge you have to share about this topic. And for the listeners, something Ellie and I discussed before we started recording is that this topic is going to be aimed more for solitary practitioners, which I think is fantastic. I feel like thinking of ecstatic practice, which we should probably go into what that is in a moment, but I tend to think of like a group of people. So I was really excited to hear that we were able to, or that this was going to be tailored for a solitary individual. I think that that's fantastic. But yeah, Ellie, to start, what is ecstatic practice for those who don't know?
So ecstatic, it comes from the Greek and it's ecstasis, which means to stand outside. So ecstasy is about taking a step outside of yourself, or a half step outside of yourself, and standing apart. So it's that really those altered states of consciousness. And I sort of usually talk about two kind of halves of that, where you've got the up and out or down and in. Because for me, ecstasy encompasses trance practice and meditative practices, or they can be ecstatic. They can take you ecstasis outside of yourself. But people often kind of think of those more meditative or trancey things as something slightly different from the ecstatic bit, which they think is a lot more frenzied. But actually, I'm going to be covering both of those things today.
Yeah, I love this. I love that description of like up and out or down and in. I think that's a really cool way to put it. Just like getting out of your mind and into your body. Yeah, I think that's awesome.
And like there are different levels of ecstatic practice. So one that a lot of people will have experienced is the first bit of ecstasy, which is a flow state. And people might have had this whilst they're driving and you're driving along. And then suddenly you realize that you've veered slightly or you've just passed your turning and you had no idea because you've been zoned out and concentrating on the driving. And that's taken you into a flow state. And that's the first kind of level. And these are different brainwave patterns often. And you kind of go from that all the way into deep trance. And we've seen, you know, you can see like videos online of people doing that. Some of the trance work that they do in voodoo and voodon with the total trance possession. And those really cool, really kind of extreme ecstatic states are really interesting. And then you've got really good, great examples in the European traditions, particularly a really good friend of mine, Francesco Dimitri, who's a great author. You should check out his books. He talks about the tarantella, which is this ecstatic dance in Italy that was played with this really, really fast beat, and women would dance and dance and dance and dance and dance until they fell down on the floor. So there's some really, really interesting practices out there that we as witchcraft practitioners can work with and practice and get into those really different states.
I think it's important to note with trance states, because when I first came into witchcraft, and I was hearing people talk about trance states, I used to think that I had an issue with getting into trance because my thought, my only preconceived notion of it was like what you see in Hollywood, right? Of people completely zoned out. But I like that you gave that example, Ellie, of like when you're driving in your car and you realize you missed your exit or you just kind of zoned out. Like that is definitely an example of trance. I realized too, like there would be times where I'd be in ritual and then I'd finish ritual and everything. And then when I tried to think about what did I do in ritual, it'd be very fuzzy. And I'd be like, wait, why am I having issues remembering like what I did? And then I'm like, oh, well, that's a trance state that I was in without even realizing it. So getting into a trance state is not necessarily like this Hollywood image that somebody who is very new might have in their mind. It could just be like this relaxed, calm, zoned out kind of state. But it can also be very intense too. So there's definitely levels to it.
And I think that lots of people will have experienced trance states, but they won't be necessarily thinking about them in their witchcraft context. So if you've been out clubbing and you've been going and going and going and going, and then you step outside into the cold air and you're like, oh my God. And like you felt completely different in that place. And dancing and concerts and all of those really kind of high emotion, high energy spaces, often people go into a level of trance in them.
Yeah. I mean, there's also people get into trance states every night when they go to sleep.
They do.
And that's one way to put it as well. Like we go into trance every night.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, with that trance, with that stepping outside of them yourself and sleep states, dream and conscious dreaming, lucid dreaming is one of those practices. And I feel like they're all connected together, which kind of brings me into the why of ecstatic practice, because I think it's really, really important to do it. And one of the phrases that I really like is you cannot be a witch alone. And for me, that doesn't mean what a lot of people think it means, right? A lot of people think it means you have to be in a coven, and I absolutely don't believe that. But I think it means that you need to be connected to other people or other beings, let's say. And ecstatic practice, stepping outside of yourself, getting into those trance states, helps you connect. For me, it's really, really about connection. And I think that it can help you connect to spirit, and to your ancestors, to the spirits that you worship, to the spirits of place, but also to the spirits of the other people around you. So if you are working in a group, that does help with connecting with other people. But I think really importantly, connecting with that kind of community of spirits that you have around you. And I think ecstatic practice is incredibly important for that.
So I wanted to back up for 1 second and say that one of the examples that you had gave earlier about getting into this ecstatic practice with like the dancing and dancing and dancing, I actually was kind of reminded of, if you've seen Midsommar, like the movie with Florence Pugh, at the scene where she has the like the mushroom tea and they're dancing and dancing and dancing until pretty much everybody falls over till there's one person left to be the May Queen. It just very much reminded me of that scene. And I meant to say that earlier.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we'll put a pin in that and we'll come back around to that later, because that's a really good example of something that I want to talk about with the hows.
Oh, perfect.
So that kind of that stepping outside of yourself and that connecting, I think it's so important to connect to your spirits and to connect to your ancestors if you do ancestor working, and to connect with to the spirits of place around you. And I think that there's a lot of kind of doing that with divination and augury. So, you know, people will observe the movements in flames and the movements in smoke, or work with their tarot cards maybe to get those messages from spirit. But I think that doing ecstatic practice and repeatedly doing ecstatic practice, changing your brain state, getting into trance, getting into that kind of ecstasis position, really helps you connect with your intuition and your subconscious and unconscious, and helps you develop your psychic powers, but also really can help you get into that space where you are more open to that communion with spirits, with the power, and with magic.
So for those that are listening to this, and before we get into how to do this, I want to ask, for those who might be listening, what would you recommend to people who might be thinking, I really want to do this, but I'm nervous to do this, or like, I can't make a lot of noise, or I can't, you know, maybe they live at home with their family. Like, is this something that people just have to work through in terms of like feeling awkward if they start getting into this type of practice? Or like, what would you recommend on that instance?
So I think there's lots and lots of different ways of doing it. And I think this is one of the problems, because people often do one thing or maybe two things and go, I can't do it. That's not for me. But actually, because there's loads of different ways of doing it, you have to kind of work out what are good ways for you. And then the other thing, my big tip would be layering them. So taking multiple different things and kind of putting them on top of the other. So for example, you know, you might have some sage tea for the thujin that's in that, which is a really good herb to help with this practice. And to be clear, I mean common sage, not any spiritually important sages that you might have in North America to traditions there. So common sage, absolutely great. And then you might layer that with some drumming or with some music. And like, even if you're living with other people where you might not want to make a lot of noise, everybody's usually okay with you putting some music on in your own room, right? So a tea or maybe a little bit of alcohol, some really good music for this, and then maybe some breath work, right? So there are definitely quiet and small ways that you can do this, which isn't screaming, dancing around a bonfire.
Well, that's definitely good to hear. I live in an apartment, so I wouldn't be able to scream and dance around a bonfire here. No. But so, Ellie, all right, let's get into the deep of it. Sorry. All right. So how does one get into this zone? Like, what should somebody do?
So I think there's three really important things to start off with. So the first is your mindset going into this. So with any magical work, actually, I think that you should really have a good mindset going into it. So whatever practices that you do around grounding or centering, you should absolutely do those, and that you should be clear on why you're doing this practice, in the same way that you should be clear when you're doing any spell or ritual, why you're doing that spell or ritual. And that isn't to go that it can't be because I want to have an awesome night. It can absolutely be because I want to experiment with this tea, or I want to experiment with this style of drumming, and that's why I'm doing it, as long as you're clear on why you're doing it. It doesn't have to be because I'm doing this very important working, or I'm communing with these very important spirits, right? It doesn't need to be a serious reason, but it's really important to have your mindset right, and that you shouldn't be going into it worried or scared about what you're doing. You might be wanting to do the practice because you are worried and you're doing it as a soothing thing, right? But like, that mindset, I think, is really, really important going into the practice. And then the second bit is the setting in which you're doing it in. And there's two parts to this. One is that you should feel safe where you're doing it, and that you feel like you should have some kind of control over that space. And that might mean that, you know, you're in your room with your family next door, or that you're in your room and you've got your housemates around, or like you, that you're in a flat and you've got people above or below you. And that's not to say that you can't do it, but you need to be aware of what you can do in that space and how you're comfortable there. And I think that's really important. I'm saying really important a lot because it is really important. but the second bit of the setting piece is making it feel magical. I think it's so important to make it feel magical. So set up your magical space however that feels good for you. Have your magical tools out. If you use tarot or another type of divination, have it there. Dress things up nicely, light some candles, put some soft LED lights on, put on your fairy lights, make the space feel magical to you, because it is so much easier to get into that headspace if you're not looking at your homework, or if you're not looking at your pile of washing in the corner. Now, I'm not saying you need to get up and do your homework or put away your pile of washing, but maybe shove it behind the curtain so that you can't see it. So yeah, that set and setting piece are kind of the key basis to go into the ecstatic practice. One of the things that I've heard a lot of people on Witch Talk and Instagram talking about is protection. And I think this is probably less important than a lot of people think it is. I know that, that's quite an unpopular thing to say, but you don't expect somebody to come and bash your door down, right? You're not like under a constant state of attack in your home. And I don't believe that you are like psychically or energetically either. I think that if you have a good relationship with the space that you're in, if you have a good relationship with what's going on around you, then you probably don't need to do a lot more than you would normally do with this. So I myself will cast a circle, I'll carry some incense around, I'll have my candles lit, but that's it. I don't do anything extra special because I'm going to do an ecstatic practice.
I love that you bring that up, actually, because this is such a hot topic right now on the witchcraft internet scene of overprotection and overbanishment. And I've seen people posting about this topic and posting how people will constantly be doing, let's say, the LBRP every single day, and they're constantly cleansing and banishing things in their space. And then they're having trouble connecting with different spirits and they're asking why. And I mean, the obvious answer is that you are over banishing your space. I mean, if you want to make sure that you're not having certain things come to you, then like it's not a problem. Like there's no issue doing the LBRP every day if that's part of your practice. But I love that you bring that up, Ellie. Like if you want to connect with certain spirits, perhaps maybe just see where your space is at the moment before completely cleansing it, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that you need to think about the spiritual world around you in the same way that you would a piece of woodland. You don't want it to be a monoculture. You don't want to scrub it clean. You want it to be in kind of a healthy balance, and you want to be one being and one spirit that is in communion and community with the energy and the spiritual world around you. And if you just clear everything out, then it's like you've gone, this is my plot of land here, and just cut down everything and salted the ground. And like, great, now I've got this clean piece of dirt around me and I am safe. And you might be safe, but you're also very lonely and it's not a very nice place to live.
Exactly. Like you might not have any weeds intruding your yard at that point, but you might not have any grass either.
No. And you know what the best thing for keeping the weeds out or keeping the nasties out is? Having a really strong community of spirit around you, right? If you've got the equivalent of the big tree casting shade, or the really nice, in the UK, we have really nice like periwinkles and green alkanets. I don't know what the similar thing is in the US. And that kind of keeps out the poison ivy and the stinging nettles, right? Because they don't have the space to grow because all of the great things that are there.
Yeah, I love that we're bringing this up in this episode. I think it's definitely like good food for thought for people to consider. Again, nothing wrong at all if this is part of your practice and you like engaging in, you know, cleansing your space. But also don't forget, you can call things back in and you can have offerings to develop these relationships with spirits. There's things you could do to cultivate this relationships that you with the spirits around you, that you don't need to banish things every single day.
And actually, I think that leads really well into kind of one of the first techniques of ecstatic practice, which is using substances. So my favorite ones are frankincense, red wine, and sage, common European sage. And actually, that frankincense at the beginning, I use frankincense in my rituals, and frankincense has been shown to have mind-altering effects. Very, very mild, but it does have mind-altering effects. But it's also a great offering. So we use incense to sort of clear our space, but we don't use it in a kind of salt way of clearing our space, right? It's not kind of purification. And it's an offering to my spirits as well when I am putting the incense down. So I've got that frankincense, you know, working on me, working on my brain and my breath, but also making an offering to those spirits that are there. And similarly with the wine, you know, I'll have some myself, but I will also offer. So I think it's really important bringing that in as well.
So I remember when I was in my outer court training, I was very, very new into the witchcraft scene. And I went to my local pagan pride, and it was my first time going to anything like that. And I went to, I think it was the very first workshop I ever went to. And somebody said something that really just blew my mind in that workshop. And they talked about how incense can be a mind altering substance.
Yeah.
And I was like, what do you mean? It's just incense. Like, it just smells good. But that was something that just really kind of shook me at the moment, like that little tidbit of information. But it is, it's not, you know, you're not going to go out there and feel like you're on acid or like you smoked weed or anything like that, but it does, you know, alter your mind. It can open you up a little bit more. It can call the spirits in. It can have a sense or cause a sense of relaxation and things being calm. Yes. And that alters you. And yeah, so quick little information, I guess, for those who didn't know, that was something that blew my mind when I first found that out.
And I think that frankincense is a really safe way of doing this. It is, I know that frankincense is expensive, but it is cheaper than other mind-altering green herbs that people might burn, right? and people are perfectly willing to spend money on that. So I would really encourage people to get some frankincense and try with frankincense. And I think that kind of leads into this layering thing, which is my shtick, layering these methodologies that can help you get into trance and get into ecstatic states and big bang. So the use of substances is really interesting, and I do use different substances. And as I said, mine are wine, sage, and frankincense. But lots of people, you may have heard of like using peyote in South America, and you can go and do these peyote rituals where you take this drug and you have a whole night and there's lots of vomiting and horrible physical things happening, but you have amazing visions. You do have this big ecstatic experience. And there's obviously quite a few drugs that you can have those big ecstatic experiences. And I call those the big bangs. You can go and do peyote in South America. You can go to Amsterdam and do mushrooms, and you will have these ecstatic experiences.
You can take some ayahuasca.
You take some ayahuasca. It's not particularly accessible. You don't want to be doing it in your bedroom when there's a whole lot of other people in the house. And you often need quite a lot of support and help to do it, and it can be quite scary. And I don't think it's necessary. It can be really interesting. It can be absolutely life-changing, but it is not necessary. I have achieved ecstatic states without having any of those big bang methodologies. And that's because I've layered them. So I will have I'll have a glass of wine. I will light the frankincense. And then I'll use some flying ointment. And my flying ointment is mugwort and sage essential oil in a base oil carrier, right? I use olive oil with a little bit of beeswax mixed in so it smooths into the skin nicely. And that's like my first stage. And that is using substances. Other people I know can use things that are slightly stronger than that, but I think that's a really, really great and accessible way to start off your ecstatic practice, right? And I do have the recipe for the flying ointment that I use that is incredibly safe. And when this comes out, I will make that available so that people can see that if they want to make it themselves, because I know everybody loves a flying ointment, but there are some scary ingredients in some of those flying ointments online. So this one's effective and fair safe.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I have flying ointment. I don't particularly like using it because it's not that I don't like using it. I get nervous using it because regardless of how reputable the seller is, some of those ingredients can kill you or cause very, very negative adverse reactions. And so using it frightens me a bit. Yeah. Because I've had bad reactions to things in the past. And so the idea of using a flying ointment with things like mugwort and common sage seem a lot more accessible and not as terrifying to me, because those are things I know I'm not going to have a horrific reaction to.
Yeah, you'd have to drink it in order to poison yourself. So don't drink it, and don't lick yourself, right? But apart from that, it's really safe. And it sounds like it shouldn't work, but it absolutely does. It absolutely does. But it works because you're using it with other things. You know, if you put some on and then went for a walk down the street, you'd be like, meh. But me and a group of friends went to the Highland concert in London, which was amazing.
Anybody, I'm going next week.
You're going next week.
Yeah. Well, I've seen them once before, but yeah, I'm going again next week.
So good. So I took my sage flying oil, my sage and mugwort flying oil. We whacked it on. We are going mental in the crowd. It was so good.
Oh my gosh. Love that.
And like a friend came back from the bar and went, I could find you all by the smell of mugwort, guys.
I never thought of taking flying ointment at a Highland concert. That's so funny. So I love that idea. I might need to make some before next week.
It's such a good ritual. It was such a good ritual, the Highland concert. So yeah, really safe, really easy. Same with alcohol. And it doesn't have to be a lot, right? Like, I'm not drinking 3 glasses of wine before ritual. I am having 1 small glass of wine. And it's just those little ways in. And then there's 4 different... base methodologies that I use in addition to the substances. There's the mental aspect, so meditation, concentration, mindfulness, those kinds of really meditative aspects. Then you've got breath control, and you've got something called blood control, which sounds scary and isn't. So I'll come back to that one first once I finish the list. And you've got rhythm. So I'm going to start off with blood control, because that's the one where people are like, oh no, blood. But actually, blood control means it's really about your heart rate and your blood moving around your body rather than like letting blood or anything like that. Absolutely not about letting blood. So a lot of people will have experienced a type of ecstatic practice that comes from a combination of breath control and blood control, and that is exercise. So if you've ever run for quite a long time, you kind of go into this like really great zone. And I'm saying this because other people have told me this, because I have absolutely never run long enough to get into that really great zone.
I surprisingly have done this, and it shocks me every time.
Yeah. And that's because what we're doing is we are getting the blood pumping way more around our body, and we're changing and often really kind of making our breath rate really rhythmic, you know, in and out in quite a standard way, because we're exercising and we're not thinking about it. And that does stuff to us, right? It gets our blood pumping. It changes the rate of oxygen that we've got going to our brain. Now, I'm not suggesting that people jog on the spot for ritual. So I guess the question is how do you do this practically? So you can use movement, right? You can use dancing. You can use shaking. I've used shaking before, which is really interesting, which is literally like, it's really difficult to explain. It's literally shaking yourself. If you want to read a really good book on the shaking practice, there's Jan Fries Seethe Ways, which is spelt S-E-I-D-R Ways, because it's the Norse Seethe practice, and that you get this blood flow going. The other way is to take it the other direction and change your blood flow by constricting blood flow. Now, I do not recommend using any kind of binding practice when you are on your own. So I am not talking here about using rope or anything like that for this. This is about positional stuff. And you see this a lot in yoga. But if you take particular positions, so if you sit cross-legged and upright, or kneeling down on your heels for a long amount of time, you're constricting your blood vessels and your joints, right, by sitting in that position for a long amount of time. And that really changes how the blood is going around your body and the level of oxygen. And that kind of takes us again to that in and down and that up and out. And if you want that kind of more ecstatic flavor that what people would normally think of as ecstatic, you probably want to be dancing. And if you want that more calm and down, then you're going to want to be reducing the amount that your blood is going around your body and the amount that your heart is beating. But they're both blood control, right? They're both blood control.
I want to mention how I think sometimes people can underestimate how much like moving your blood around can affect you. I've gotten really into like strength training and such over the last like almost 2 years. And, you know, during times in my past before I was really into that, let's say I hurt my back or something, or like my muscles are really sore from, maybe not hurt my back, but yeah, let's say my muscles are very sore. My initial instinct would have been, I am just going to rest and maybe using heating pad. And sometimes that's not the worst, or sometimes that's not the wrong answer. But my trainers have taught me that getting up and moving around and getting your blood pumping gets blood to those areas and helps to heal them. And that sometimes just having it be stagnant and just sit there doesn't do much. And so then that also translates into your mental state too, where if you're just laying around waiting for, you know, your muscles to stop hurting, you know, that can sometimes be a bit of a downer. But if you get up and you start moving, you know, that releases endorphins and it changes your mood. And so that kind of relates to what we're talking about with altering your conscious a bit, where if you get the blood pumping, it's going to automatically change your mood. Now, sometimes if you're running for a bit, your mood might get a little down because you're annoyed that you're running. But if you keep going long enough, you can get into like this trance state with it where you're just, your body is just on autopilot. It's really cool, like what the human body can do and how your blood can affect that.
Yeah, no, completely. And I think that we need to remember how powerful blood is. And I don't advocate for blood sacrifice or anything like that, although I do have deep respect for those traditional practices that do. But our blood in our bodies is really powerful. And I think it's a really important way that we move power around our bodies, like literally, you know, the magical power that's inside ourselves. And you might want to take those seating postures or those kind of quite small postures and really be kind of pulling your energy in and quietening it down and taking it and centralizing it. Or you might be trying to create more energy and get it really up and out of yourself, both for perfectly good magical reasons and both of them able to create ecstatic states, and using the way that your blood is flowing to support that is really good magic.
All right, so we will be back in a moment. All right, welcome back. I just can't help but think of like this, and we talked about this at the beginning of the episode, for those who might be nervous to do this sort of thing, like, you know, running around their home to get their blood pumping to induce this sort of state. I know that sometimes that can be very awkward feeling, like maybe you just don't want to do that because you're just like, oh, like, I don't know. But I found that sometimes doing those things that kind of scare you a little bit end up having such fantastic results, because sometimes it's just your mind is getting in the way of the outcome. And so I don't know, I would just recommend just try it. Try it out.
Completely. And I think that what we've got to remember is witchcraft is supposed to be on the edge.
Yes.
And it's supposed to be challenging. And it's supposed to be challenging to the norm. And my good friend Francesco, again, Francesco Dimitri is great. He talks about witchcraft challenging the patriarchy, challenging structures of power, challenging the norms. Now, if you're a witch and you're perfectly happy to be completely normal all of the time, then I think we maybe need to have a bit of a rethink about what's going on here, right? Now, I need to be completely normal at work, but when I'm doing my witchcraft, I absolutely don't need to be completely normal. And this is going on a complete tangent. It's not a complete tangent, it's going on a bit of a tangent. If you look at the history of these ecstatic practices, the church and state absolutely hated them. because they were women and working class people, and often working class women, the church and state do not like working class women, taking power into their own hands and doing things that were disruptive and out of the norm. Now, I'm not saying that you need to go and do this in the middle of a church or in your local park, but own the fact that you are doing something that is transgressive and something that is powerful and something that is disruptive, because witchcraft should be transgressive and powerful and disruptive. So go, yeah, I'm feeling silly in my room on my own doing this, but that is a powerful magical act in and of itself.
You know, it's funny too, is that it's not just witchcraft that does practice, or, you know, people in paganism, or, well, of course not. It's not just us that do these sorts of practices, but even Pentecostal Christians do this. They speak in tongues, they throw themselves on the ground, they're rolling around, they're letting the Holy Spirit, you know, be around them and help with these ecstatic practice and these just going crazy, not crazy, but just going all out. And so, if you look at it in that aspect too, I mean, this is not just a witchcraft thing. This is universal.
Yeah. These are technologies of connecting to yourself and to spirit and getting out of your head that work, but they've always been part of witchcraft.
Absolutely.
And I've gotten completely distracted there. So we've talked about the substances. So wine, incense, and flying ointment for me. And then the blood control. The third part of it that is really important and connects in so closely is breath work. And breath work, I think, is absolutely essential and really, really effective. And it can be effective on its own. But what I would encourage everybody to do is layer all of these things together. So breath work, so it can come in a really, really simple form where you're doing, you're just concentrating on your breath, you know, like they do in like mindfulness practice. So I think the optimum is in for six and out for six, and in for six and out for six. And I have done a ritual where I put on a drumming track and I lay down on the floor, made myself as comfy as possible, and I just did in for six and out for six. And I was going to do 15 minutes of this. And I thought I had done 15 minutes of it. And when I finished the ritual and I went to go and look at my phone, it had played through the 15-minute track three times. So I had done 45 minutes of in for six and out for six by accident.
I love when that happens.
I just spaced out so much. That was all we were doing. You know, that was all I'd done. I just had the incense, a glass of wine, the drumming on the track, and the breath work.
I love when I do rituals and I do some sort of trance or meditative practice and I think to myself, oh, I was doing that for maybe 5 minutes or so, and I look and 25 minutes, 30 minutes have passed. The opposite has also happened though too, where I'm like, oh, I was definitely in that for a long time, and I look and only 5 minutes has passed. So it can go both ways.
Yeah. Ritual, timey-wimey. And I think that's there's a ritual right there that anybody can go and do, go away and do tonight, right? So light a candle, put some incense on. If you can't use incense because you've got a fire alarm or something, put your oil burner on, put some sage essential oil in there, put some frankincense essential oil in there, put a little bit of sage essential oil and some olive oil and put that on your skin, and then put on your headphones or put it on your record player if you can. God, that makes me sound really old. I'm not old enough to have a record player. Put it on your put it playing on your phone if out loud if you can, and lie down on your bed and breathe. And then once you've done that for a while, past the point where you're like, oh God, this is boring, through to, oh God, have I been doing this for too long, and out the other side of that, do that for as long as you can, and then sit up and do your preferred method of divination. Stare into a candle flame, look into a black mirror, or read your tarot cards, throw your runes, right? And I did that ritual and I looked into my black mirror and I had some of the best visions that I've ever had from a really quite small, self-contained, quiet practice. that was still really, really effective because I'd layered all of those different things together.
I think it's really important to put those things together and just to like build yourself up to the best, setting yourself up for success.
Yeah.
I think is a really good way to put this of you have the music, you have the wine, you have the incense going, you are perhaps sitting in a certain way to cut off circulation in some sort of way. All of these different things that you could do, I think, build upon each other, and layering them together, I think, is such a smart way of going about this.
Yeah. And I think it's a really safe way of going about it as well. You know, you're not having to like sit until your legs go numb or take a whole load of very mind-altering drugs, or, you know, there's amazing practices that they do in Kundalini yoga where they breathe for ages and ages and ages and ages. And I didn't need to breathe for 9 hours, right? I did it in 45 minutes because I added a whole load of witchcraft around it. And actually, I think that with the breath work, the second thing that is really effective is chanting, because chanting takes us to this place where we do have to have a regular in-breath and a regular out-breath. And that's often actually a short in-breath and a long out-breath because we're chanting. And that is so good. That short in and a long out is really, really good for changing our brain state, getting into that altered state of consciousness. And I've got two tips on chanting. Either should be something that you love and you know really, really well, or it should sound like complete nonsense. So I've got, what do I use? There's one that I use. So I chanted all the way through the delivery of my first child.
Oh, I love that.
Because the midwife was like, breath work really helps. And like they were teaching like, you know, in for two, out for two, in for four, out for four kind of things in my antenatal class. And I went, hold up. I'm a witch. I've already got a breath work practice. I will chant. So like I did The River is Flowing, which is quite a famous reclaiming chant, I think from the 1960s and 70s. And I knew it really, really well. So I didn't have to think about it because I knew it really well. So taking a chant that you know really, really well is great. And that doesn't have to be like a witchy chant. It can be a song that seems appropriate for what you're doing that you know really well. Or you go the other way and you come up with something which is abstracted. So I'm hoping that a lot of people who've been listening to this have done sigils before. And if you haven't done sigils, I recommend going away and looking at Austin Osman Spare or reduction sigils. And one of the things that I really like doing is creating reduction sound sigils. So what I'll do is I'll take the phrase for my spell. And whereas if you were doing a written sigil, you'd get rid of all of the vowels and then you'd take the consonants and you'd layer the consonants together. What I do for a sound sigil, and this isn't my idea, this is a great friend of mine, Stuart, who is a singing teacher, and he came up with this and it's really great, is you take the vowels. So if it was connection, I'd take the ah and the eh in connection. And I'd use that as a chant. So I'd go, oh, so you've abstracted that idea and you've turned it into something that's easy to say, but you've kept it's still got the meaning in it in the same way that you do with a sigil, but you've now got something to chant that relates directly to what you're doing, but it's not engaging your like conscious thinky mind, it's then taking you into that abstract subconscious mind.
Ellie, can I just say that you completely blew my mind just now? I have never thought about doing that, and I love doing like creating sigils, and I don't know why I've never considered that, but I'm absolutely going to be taking this idea for my own personal practice. So thank you so much for saying that. My mind's literally blown right now.
It's really great. And like, actually, you can, if you want to use it to empower a sigil that you've done, you've got the consonant sigil on the piece of paper in front of you, and you can use the chant of the vowels that you've taken out to empower the sigil that you've made. When my friend came up with this idea, I was like, this is so sweet, and I absolutely love it. So taking doing a chant that is nonsense or doing a chant that you know really well. And there are like lots of other ways to make like nonsense chants, right? Like I've got a friend who speaks Basque and he writes them in Basque. So he understands what they mean. I've got no idea what they mean. And they are great to chant because they actually have meaning in and of themselves, but they're not like me engaging with my conscious mind, my analytical mind with these words.
I gotta say, like this is just me being for myself. I love doing this podcast and speaking with people from so many different parts of just the world and different views of their practice, because like learning these little tidbits, it's like my mind's literally blown right now. Like you have no idea, because sigils is such a big part of my practice. And so I'm so stoked at this moment. I need to stop like freaking out about this, but I cannot wait to tell my entire coven about this idea.
So I think then the next bit, which actually connects into everything that we've been talking about, is the last bit that I think is really important, is rhythm. And this is something weird with our brains that everybody knows, right? This has been known all the way back in history. This is why drumming and dancing and all of those things are so important, is that we need to be doing all of this with rhythm. And that if we do dancing or breath work or singing or drumming, the rhythmic nature of it is absolutely key to entering those trance states. So you've got the fact that you've had a glass of wine, you've got some incense going, you're doing breath work or you're singing. Try and reinforce the rhythm of it however you can. So I will rock, or I will dance, or I will chant, I will drum at the same time, all really great. So with the rhythm, the rate of the rhythm has an effect. So with the drumming, I love drumming, the speed for like trance drumming is really, really quite fast. So I don't know how this is going to sound on the podcast. Sorry to everybody, but I kind of go at this rate. So it's quite a fast drumming technique. And if you go with that, that has been shown to change our brainwaves and change our heart rate. And we kind of end up kind of in sync with it. And you can find recordings on YouTube, you can find recordings on Spotify, whatever kind of streaming audio service you use, you'll be able to find recordings of that. So you can use it, or you can do it yourself. And I love getting a drum and sitting there and drumming myself, right? And I think that's a really, really effective way of doing it. And remember to layer in your breathing, right? Don't hold your breath whilst you're doing that. Keep your breathing going whilst you're doing that, or chant whilst you're doing it, something like that. And I think that's a really, really great way. And then if you use a slow beat, you're kind of, you are going into that slower and deeper state. Whereas the faster rate will do that kind of up and out. So that fast rate is the rate that in traditional shamanic practices, they'll use whilst journeying. So that's really, really great. I know that a lot of people get worried about cultural appropriation. I am English. I am very English. And I have done a lot of research into this, and I am comfortable using drumming as part of my witchcraft practices. We know that it's obviously used in Ireland, but there was also an English tradition with a particular drum called a rattle drum, which unfortunately you can't buy anymore, they don't make anymore, that was made out of sheepskin, but a similar round frame drum. So I use that in my practice, not a rattle drum. I use an Irish bodhrán, because you can't buy the English rattle drums anymore. So the drumming is really, really great. Or if you're doing a slow chant, that obviously has a different vibe to doing a fast chant. Or if you're doing a slow rock or a slow breath, you know, and you can play with these different things. And some of you might find that it's the really, really up energy thing that gets you out of your head. And some of you might find that it's the really, really slow stuff that gets you out of your head. And other people might find it's in the median. And none of it is wrong. And some things will work at some times for you, and other things will work at other times for you. So don't do one thing and go, oh God, I can't do this. Like, try different stuff out. Try different methodologies out. Try it at different times of day, when you're feeling in a different way, and kind of go with what's the right vibe for you and keep going. I think that's the most important thing. Keep going. Keep going past I'm bored, and keep going past I'm feeling silly. Because this isn't stupid, and it's not wrong, and it's not messing around. So don't do it like you're messing around. Do it like you're mean it and go for it. And even if you haven't managed it the first time, you might manage it the second, or you might manage it the third. And even if you haven't managed it to the state that you want to manage it, your effort will be noticed and it will be appreciated. Or it certainly is. My gods and my spirits notice and appreciate my effort. And then when I do get there, it's like, yeah, well done. You did it. Woo, go you.
Yeah, I was going to mention that as well, too, is that if you just try one or two or three times and you're not really getting much from it, keep going, keep trying, try different techniques, try different layering techniques. You know, maybe frankincense isn't the incense you should burn. Maybe you should try a different one.
Yeah.
Maybe wine doesn't work for you. Maybe have some tea instead, or a shot of whiskey.
Yeah.
There's different things you can do. You could try it fast. You could try it slow. Give it a good try, a couple of tries, because you're not always going to get things nailed down on the very first or second or third try. It takes time and it takes effort, and it's not always instantaneous.
And I'd quite like to come back around to the midsummer thing that you talked about earlier. So the layering, she danced like a crazy person, but she also had mushroom tea, right? So it's that do lots and lots of things. Do lots and lots of things. Do lots and lots of things all together. Layer it up, you know, like, deck out your room, light the candles, light the incense, have the glass of wine with a shot of mugwort liquor in it, you know, burn your frankincense, chuck some sage on it, you know, whatever your favorite things are, make it rich and make it textured, and make that an offering to your gods and spirits, but also make it an offering to yourself, and create this sacred space that allows you to let go.
Two things. One, I'm about to Google mugwort liquor and see if that's a thing near me, or how to make it. Maybe with some Everclear. I've never heard of that before. That's pretty cool. But two, in Midsummer, in that scene, and for those who have not seen this, you should watch the movie. It's fantastic. In that scene, what is important is not only is she drinking the tea, not only is she dancing, but the music too. Mm. In the very beginning of that scene, the music is pretty high energy and it's fast paced. But at the very end, when it's getting to the end, the music actually slows down quite a bit. Mm. And it gets a lot more trancey and vibey and, you know, exhaustive. So that's also one thing to keep in mind too. If you can't uphold this super, super high, fast paced energy, but you want to try it, don't feel like it's all or nothing. You can absolutely mix it up.
So Ashley and I have been saying, keep trying it, right? Keep going, try out different things. And I kind of want to loop back to why. Like, why should you put in all of this effort? And I feel like there's a laundry list of reasons why this is a good thing. So we talked a little bit at the beginning about connection and connecting to your spirits. I also think it's really important for connecting with yourself. So connecting with your own subconscious, your unconscious and your intuition, but also, it sounds weird, standing outside of yourself can help you actually connect to your body. And I think, and lots and lots of other people who have practiced this around the world now, but also through history, find these practices immensely healing. They can be psychologically healing, and they can also be physically healing. And there are lots of scientific reasons as to why, and I encourage you to go off and search PubMed for them, but it's a really healing practice. It develops your psychic powers. You know, repeatedly doing these things makes it easier to do them. And when you are not doing them, it can make it easier for you to be able to access and also decide not to access whatever your own psychic powers are.
I think it's also great to develop ritual triggers. If you get used to a practice of, let's say, listening to drumming and having a glass of wine and lighting some incense, and maybe you do it in that order, you know, like if you do that enough times, your conscious kind of shifts a bit. It's like, oh, okay, we're about to get into something. We're about to change our surroundings. We're about to do something a little bit out of the mundane. And that's a great, great way to start building up a trigger.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And different people have different things, right? Like scent is really important for me. So that first smell of the frankincense. But I've got a friend who, for her, it's the swish of the broom on the floor. She likes sweeping her circle with a witch's broom, like a proper witch's broom before ritual. And that noise is really important for her. And like, I recommend to people to pay attention to what are the senses that you rely on and that are really helpful to trigger you, and work with them and like lean into it.
And this might sound somewhat silly, but if you have the opportunity to practice with other people, let's say you are in a coven, you can actually, if you are having difficulty developing a trigger or you think that you don't have one, you can ask your coven mates if they think that you have one. And I can give an example of this where I noticed that there was a particular thing that somebody, actually multiple people in my coven, were doing right before a ritual every single time. And they were doing it without realizing. They'd be talking and they would be doing this particular motion in our room where we would have circle. And one day I brought it up to them and I was like, oh, you're getting ready for ritual, huh? And they were like, what are you talking about? And I pointed out this motion that they were constantly doing. And they were like, oh my God, I never even noticed that I did that, but you're right. And I was like, I have noticed it every single time you have come here that you start doing this right before we're about to get into ritual. Sorry for being so vague, but I apologize.
They were all pulling their left ear repeatedly.
Yes, yes, exactly. I apologize for the vagueness of this example, but I promise there was something that they were doing. And I've actually caught myself doing it a couple times too, but... So you can also ask the people around you, like, have you noticed me doing anything before ritual? There's a chance they might say no, because sometimes people are just kind of in their own world, especially before starting a ritual. But it doesn't hurt to ask if you're having any difficulty, if people have noticed things around you.
And that, and the working with other people thing, I think, is really interesting. And that's going to bring me back round again to layering. And I do keep on banging out on about layering because I think it's really important.
It is so important.
Yeah, which is that if you are practicing with other people, breath work might not work for you and drumming might, but the person next to you, drumming might not be so good, but breath work might be great. And if you're only doing one thing for your ecstatic practice, then it might not work for the other people that you're doing ritual with. It also might not work for you all of the time. Whereas if you layer lots of stuff up, the things are more likely to work for more people around the room, but are also more likely to work for you at different times.
I love that you brought that up, because I know of people where things like drumming helps get them into the ritual mindset and helps them get ready for this type of practice. But for other people in the room, they cannot stand the drumming. And to them, it's bothersome. There could be another example too, where perhaps somebody really likes lighting this one incense, but maybe somebody else in the room has an allergy to that incense, or they just absolutely cannot stand the smell and it knocks them out of it. So it's very important, especially if you're working with other people, to have multiple things that you can layer on, because if for some reason you can't do step 2 out of 4, let's say that you do have at least other things kind of, you know, in your sleeve that you can pull out to help you with this. But that's also part of, you know, working with a coven, is having to adjust to the people around you as well. And they also have to adjust to you. Yeah. So it's compromise. It's like a relationship. So it is very important to have different things that you could do just in case something happens where you can't do maybe one of your most favorite types of triggers, like banging a drum. Perhaps you go on vacation and you can't bring your drum with you. Then what are you going to do? I guess you could drum on the floor, but you get what I mean.
And if anybody is ever lucky enough to get to teach other people witchcraft, don't leave stuff out. You know, people go, well, chanting didn't work for me, so it doesn't work, so I'm not going to teach it to you. And I don't think that's fair, right? There are definitely things that don't work for me. but I would never go, they don't work. And I would never go to the people who I teach, I'm not going to teach you this because it doesn't work for me. Like the thing that, you know, I said earlier about running for ages, that absolutely doesn't work for me. I do, it's called sweat catharsis. I do not get sweat catharsis ecstasy. I absolutely don't. But that doesn't mean that I don't go, it isn't a real thing. It absolutely is a real thing. And you can do it. And if this is something you want to do, go away and work with it and make sure that I'm going to make sure that you know that that is a thing and how to do that thing.
I agree. I have a bit of a bad knee and I always tell my students, like, you know, if I can't run, like, let's say we want to do something that involves running to build up that energy, y'all can run. Like, please run. I will stand in the corner and I will do my own contribution. I'll have my own contribution to the energy raising, but you guys go right ahead. Just because I can't do it or it doesn't work for me doesn't mean that it's not going to be beneficial for other people. So I love you bringing that up, Ellie. I think that's so important. As teachers, we need to teach our students everything that we can, even if it's not something that works for us, even if it's something that we don't vibe with. I'm not into astrology, but if my students, I really want to know astrology, by all means, I have support for them. It's not my thing, but that's okay. For most people like astrology. I will let them know very clearly it's not my thing, but they are free to do whatever they want. And I have people they could talk to for that area of expertise that I do not have.
You just talked there about the running around for raising energy. And I think that's really the last point I want to make on why ecstatic practice. So we've talked about the fact that it connects, and it connects with spirit, and it connects with your own subconscious, and it develops your psychic powers, and it's really healing. But I think the last thing is, it's really, really good for raising power. And you've got this kind of loop. You've got this feedback loop, because what some of the people who have listening to this might have noticed is that breath work, chanting, dancing, drumming are all ways of raising power. But my argument is that they raise power because they change us, because they change our minds, because they change our energy, they raise power. And then because our energy has changed, because our brain states are changed, because our energy levels are changed. I think I just said energy twice because I'm talking about energy a lot. that raises power. That creates ecstasy. Ecstatic states raise power. Raising power creates ecstatic states. And we're into this cycle. So you end up in this place where it's a feedback loop. Do these things, do ecstatic states, because it is incredibly powerful for your spells, because it's incredibly powerful for your magic. So they're always talking about empowering spells, right? This is how I would do it. I would get myself into this space. I would get myself into this space by doing these practices where I am open to my own power. I'm open to my subconscious and my intuition and my intent, but I'm also open to my divinities and my spirits. And I'm open to the energy in this really safe, held space with the right mindset, because I've created that. You remember we talked about that earlier. And that is the oomph that pushes my magic forward. Whether I'm then using that for divination, or whether I'm using that to empower a sigil, or whether I'm using it for like some herbal preparation that I'm making, or whether I'm using it for other types of magic where I am literally sending out my power into the world to affect the change that I want to make. We talk about like, oh, I'm going to do some drumming to raise energy. And I think we're missing out that key bit there, which is that we're doing the drumming to raise energy. And it's not just the drumming. It's not the drumming itself that raises the energy. It's the effect that the drumming has on our energy and our power and our state of mind that raises the energy. The energy is coming from us. And it is the things that we are doing, the rhythmic stuff, the breath stuff, the heart rate, the chanting, the drumming, the singing, all of those kinds of things that then creates this mindset, which creates our power, which helps us bring our power out and into the world so that we can do magic.
That is so beautifully said. And that is so true. It's not the drumming. It's not the singing. It's how that's impacting us and what that is bringing out of us and what these tools are doing to help us raise this energy and perhaps lose ourselves in that moment and just be fully there, which sounds, that sounds like a contradictive sentence, right? Losing yourself and being fully there. But yes, yes. Beautifully
said. One of the things that I've heard seekers say to me is, oh, but I don't, I'm worried about doing magic for superficial things, or I don't have anything I really need to do magic for, and I don't want to be like bothering my spirits, or, you know, like, I don't feel like I've got an important enough reason to do this. Well, you know what's a really good and important enough reason? An important enough reason is offering, right? You do this stuff, you raise this energy, and then you go, actually, this is an offering to my gods, or this is an offering to my house spirit. You know, so you've had a lovely time, you've gotten this practice in, and it's not for nothing. The energy isn't just kind of dissipating into the world. You can use it and dedicate it to your community of spirits. And I find that there's a reciprocity there. And that if I do that, then the next time I come to do some ritual, they're there and they're supporting me. And then the next time I come to do some ritual where I'm maybe not on top form, maybe something, you know, I'm really stressed, something bad has happened, or like I'm trying to find a new home at the moment. This is incredibly stressful and I'm quite tired. But I have put that into building these relationships. I've made those offerings of not only, you know, bread and wine to my household goddess, but also the energy of the practices that I've done to her. And then I come to this space, come to my circle without much energy. And you know what? It's there. Because going back to that thing at the beginning that we were talking about, I've cultivated my little patch of forest. And then when I am low, I can go into that little patch of forest and it will support me.
I gotta say, spirits love getting offerings, and it works out for both. I mean, you get a chance to practice and the spirits get fed. It's a win-win.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think one of the things is, and I want to remind both the people, the British traditional Wiccans listening to this, as well as seekers and solitary witches who are out there, I am a Gardnerian high priestess. And this is all completely within my British traditional Wicca practice, right? This is not alien to it. This is not something that is outside of it. It is completely central to it. So if you're in Wicca and think you're not doing this cool stuff, you absolutely can be. And if you're interested in Wicca, but you don't think we do this cool stuff, we absolutely do.
Love it. Well, Ellie, do you have any final comments or suggestions or advice for those who want to get started in this practice?
Do it. Don't be scared. Make sure that you're going into it with the right mindset and that you set up your space so that you feel safe and held. Keep practicing. There are lots of really, really good resources on this, and I'm going to keep an eye out for when this episode comes out. My Instagram handle is at witchful, which is witch, F-U-L, dot thoughts on Instagram. And when this comes out, I will put up some links to some really great books that really helped me looking at this, and also some good resources online that you could look at around this, because there is so much out there to know, and there is so much to do. But I'm hoping that what we've talked about today gives people some easy, simple, but really also effective and strong ways into how to do these practices.
Amazing. Yeah, I was going to say, for one resource I've heard of is this book called The Art of Losing Control by Jules Evans. I haven't personally read it, but I've heard it's pretty fantastic.
That is my Bible. It is not witchy, but it talks through some really, really good ways of doing it. And like, you can go away and go to a Kundalini class and do a whole load of breath work, or you can go to a Buddhist meditation class and do a whole load of the meditation and concentration stuff, or a five rhythms class and do the dancing stuff. And I've done a lot of that. I've done a lot of those things and like gone out and done like that, some of those, like you do dancing for 3 hours. But what I've then done is I've then bought those things back and incorporated parts of them and layered them into my witchcraft practice. So go off and do that. Like, go and find your local five rhythms class. There will be one near you and you can practice that thing, or your drumming or your XYZ, and go out and explore and find things out.
Amazing. And I have one final question for you. And that is, and you kind of already answered this question, but I'm going to ask you again in a different lens. That is, if you could give one piece of advice to a beginner, does not have to be related to the topic of this episode, it could be anything, what would you say to them?
I'd say, don't be scared. Ashley and I talked about this at the beginning, but don't be scared. You know, actually, the world around us and the spiritual world around us and the world of spirit around us is not out to get us. It's really not. You know, they say every stranger could be a friend, right? Every stranger is a friend waiting. And actually, I think that unless you are doing maleficium or malevolent things in your practice, really what is out there is mostly really, it wants to support you and it wants to be you to be there, and it is going to help you in your practice. Don't salt the earth around you, you know, open your arms wide and make offering rather than pushing things away.
Beautifully said. Well, Ellie, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. This was such a fascinating conversation. As you know, my mind was blown during parts of this, and yes, I'm very excited. As you mentioned, if anybody wants to find you on Instagram, it's witchful.thoughts.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to find me in the social media world, I'm available on Instagram as well at Seeking Witchcraft, or I have a personal Instagram if anybody's interested. It just spells and kettlebells. I have a Facebook page called Seeking Witchcraft Podcast, a Facebook group called Witches Seeking Witchcraft, where you could talk about the episodes and ask questions. And if anybody would like to support the podcast, you could do so at patreon.com/seekingwitchcraft. All right. Well, that is the end of this episode. Ellie, thank you again so much for coming on and sharing your wisdom with myself and the listeners. And gosh, I feel like we could have just kept going and going and going. This is such a fascinating topic.
Thank you so much, Ashley. It was really great to be here.
Of course. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Graham laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Graham keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Graham laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.